spent in the enchanted dwelling led me. But my disappointment arose neither from the inadequacy of the works of art that were shown to me, nor from the impossibility of fixing upon them my distracted gaze, for it was not the intrinsic beauty of the objects themselves that made it miraculous for me to be sitting in Swan's library. It was the attachment to those objects, which might have been the ugliest in the world, of the particular feeling, melancholy and voluptuous, which I had for so many years localized in that room, and which still impregnated it. Similarly, the multitude of mirrors, of silver-backed brushes, of altars to St. Anthony of Padua, carved and painted by the most eminent artists, her friends, counted for nothing in the feeling of my own unworthiness and of her regal benevolence which was aroused in me when Madame Swan received me for a moment in her own room, in which three beautiful and impressive creatures, her principal and second and third maids, smilingly prepared for her the most marvellous toilets, and towards which, on the order conveyed to me by the footman in knee-breeches, that Madame wished to say a few words to me, I would make my way along the tortuous path of a corridor, all embalmed, far and near, by the precious essences which exhaled without ceasing from her dressing-room, a fragrance exquisitely sweet. When Madame Swan had returned to her visitors, we could still hear her talking and laughing. For even with only two people in the room, and as though she had to cope with all the good friends at once, she would raise her voice, ejaculate her words, as she had so often in the little clan heard its mistress do at the moments when she led the conversation. The expressions which we have borrowed from other people being those which, for a time at least, we are fondest of using, Madame Swan used to select at one time those which she had learned from distinguished people whom her husband had not managed to prevent her from getting to know. It was from them that she derived the mannerism which consisted in suppressing the article or demonstrative pronoun in French before an adjective qualifying a person's name. At another time, others more plebeian, such as, "It's a mere nothing," the favourite expression of one of her friends, and used to make room for them in all the stories which, by a habit formed among the little clan, she loved to tell about people. She would follow these up automatically with, "I do love that story," or, "Do admit it's a very good story," which came to her through her husband from the Guermantes, whom she did not know. Madame Swan had left the dining room, but her husband, who had just returned home, made his appearance among us in turn. "Do you know if your mother is alone, Gilbert?"
"No, Papa. She has still some people."
"What, still? At 7 o'clock? It's appalling. The poor woman must be absolutely dead. It's odious." At home I had always heard the first syllable of this word pronounced with a long O, like ode, but Monsieur and Madame Swan made it short, as in odd. "Just think of it, ever since 2 o'clock this afternoon," he went on, turning to me. "And Camille tells me that between 4 and 5 he let in at least a dozen people." "Did I say a dozen? I believe he told me 14. No, a dozen. I don't remember. When I came home I had quite forgotten it was her day, and when I saw all those carriages outside the door I thought there must be a wedding in the house. And just now, while I've been in the library for a minute, the bell has never stopped ringing. Upon my word, it's given me quite a headache. And are there a lot of them in there still?"
"No, only 2.
"Who are they, do you know?"
"Madame Cottard and Madame Bonton."
"Oh, the wife of the chief secretary to the Minister of Posts."
"I know her husband's a clerk in some ministry or other, but I don't know what he does."
Gilbert assumed a babyish manner. "What's that, you silly child? You talk as if you were 2 years old. What do you mean, a clerk in some ministry or other, indeed? He is nothing less than chief secretary, chief of the whole show, and what's more, what on earth am I thinking of? Upon my word, I'm getting as stupid as yourself. He's not the chief secretary, he's the permanent secretary."
I don't know, I'm sure. Does that mean a lot, being permanent secretary?
Answered Gilberte, who never let slip an opportunity of displaying her own indifference to anything that gave her parents cause for vanity. She may, of course, have considered that she only enhanced the brilliance of such an acquaintance by not seeming to attach any undue importance to it.
"I should think it did mean a lot," exclaimed Swann, who preferred to this modesty, which might have left me in doubt, a more explicit mode of speech.
"Why, it means simply that he's the first man after the minister. In fact, he's more important than the minister, because it's he that does all the work. Besides, it appears that he has immense capacity, a man quite of the first rank, a most distinguished individual. He's an officer of the Légion d'Honneur. A delightful man he is, and very good-looking, too." This man's wife, incidentally, had married him against everyone's wishes and advice, because he was a charming creature. He had, what may be sufficient to constitute a rare and delicate whole, a fair, silky beard, good features, a nasal voice, powerful lungs, and a glass eye.
"I may tell you," he added, turning again to me, "that I'm greatly amused to see that lot serving in the present government, because they are bon ton of the bon ton chenu family. Typical old-fashioned middle-class people, reactionary, clerical, tremendously straight-laced. Your grandfather knew quite well, at least by name and sight he must have known old Chenu, the father, who never tipped the cabmen more than a halfpenny, though he was a rich enough man for those days. And the Baron Breuil Chenu? All their money went in the Union Générale smash. You're too young to remember that, of course. And gad, they've had to get it back as best they could."
"He's the uncle of a little girl who used to come to my lessons, in a class a long way below mine, the famous Albertine. She's certain to be dreadfully fast when she's older, but just now she's the quaintest spectacle."
"She's amazing, this daughter of mine. She knows everyone."
"I don't know her. I only used to see her going about and hear them calling Albertine here and Albertine there. But I do know Madame Bonton, and I don't like her much either."
"You're quite wrong. She is charming, pretty, intelligent. In fact, she's quite clever. I shall go in and say how do you do to her, and ask her if her husband thinks we're going to have war, and whether we can rely on King Theodosius. He's bound to know, don't you think, since he's in the councils of the gods?"
It was not thus that Swann used to talk in days gone by. But which of us cannot call to mind some royal princess of limited intelligence who let herself be carried off by a footman and then, 10 years later, tried to get back into society and found that people were not very willing to call upon her? Have we not found her spontaneously adopting the language of all the old bores, and when we referred to some duchess who was at the height of fashion, heard her say, "She came to see me only yesterday," or, "I live a very quiet life"? So that it is superfluous to make a study of manners, since we can deduce them all from psychological laws. The Swans shared this eccentricity of people who have not many friends. A visit, an invitation, a mere friendly word from someone ever so little prominent were for them events to which they aspired to give full publicity. If bad luck would have it that the Verdurins were in London when Odette gave a rather smart dinner party, arrangements were made by which some common friend was to cable a report to them across the Channel. Even the complimentary letters and telegrams received by Odette, the Swans were incapable of keeping to themselves. They spoke of them to their friends, passed them from hand to hand. Thus, the Swans' drawing-room reminded one of a seaside hotel where telegrams containing the latest news are posted up on a board. Still, people who had known the old Swan
not merely outside society as I had known him, but in society, in that Guermantes set which, with certain concessions to highnesses and duchesses, was almost infinitely exacting in the matter of wit and charm, from which banishment was sternly decreed for men of real eminence whom its members found boring or vulgar. Such people might have been astonished to observe that their old Swann had ceased to be not only discreet when he spoke of his acquaintance, but difficult when he was called upon to enlarge it. How was it that Madame Bontemps, so common, so ill-natured, failed to exasperate him? How could he possibly describe her as attractive? The memory of the Guermantes set must, one would suppose, have prevented him. As a matter of fact, it encouraged him. There was certainly among the Guermantes, as compared with the great majority of groups in society, taste, indeed, a refined taste, but also a snobbishness from which there arose the possibility of a momentary interruption in the exercise of that taste. If it were a question of someone who was not indispensable to their circle, of a minister for foreign affairs, a republican and inclined to be pompous, or of an academician who talked too much, their taste would be brought to bear heavily against him. Swann would condole with Madame de Guermantes on having had to sit next to such people at dinner at one of the embassies, and they would 1,000 times rather have a man of fashion, that is to say, a man of the Guermantes kind, good for nothing, but endowed with the wit of the Guermantes, someone who was of the same chapel as themselves. Only a grand duchess, a princess of the blood, should she dine often with Madame de Guermantes, would soon find herself enrolled in that chapel also, without having any right to be there, without being at all so endowed. But with the simplicity of people in society, from the moment they had her in their houses, they went out of their way to find her attractive. Since they were unable to say that it was because she was attractive that they invited her. Swann, coming to the rescue of Madame de Guermantes, would say to her after the Highness had gone, "After all, she's not such a bad woman. Really, she has quite a sense of the comic. I don't suppose for a moment that she has mastered the critique of pure reason. Still, she is not unattractive." "Oh, I do so entirely agree with you," the Duchess would respond. "Besides, she was a little frightened of us all. You will see that she can be charming."
"She is certainly a great deal less devastating than Madame X, the wife of the talkative academician, and herself a remarkable woman, who quotes 20 volumes at you."
"Oh, but there isn't any comparison between them."
The faculty of saying such things as these, and of saying them sincerely, Swann had acquired from the Duchess, and had never lost. He made use of it now, with reference to the people who came to his house. He forced himself to distinguish and to admire in them the qualities that every human being will display if we examine him with a prejudice in his favour, and not with the distaste of the nice-minded. He extolled the merits of Madame Bontemps, as he had once extolled those of the Princesse de Parme, who must have been excluded from the Guermantes set if there had not been privileged terms of admission for certain highnesses, and if, when they presented themselves for election, no consideration had indeed been paid except to wit and charm. We have seen already, moreover, that Swann had always an inclination, which he was now putting into practice only in a more lasting fashion, to exchange his social position for another which, in certain circumstances, might suit him better. It is only people incapable of analysing in their perception what at first sight appears indivisible who believe that one's position is consolidated with one's person. One and the same man, taken at successive points in his life, will be found to breathe at different stages on the social ladder in atmospheres that do not of necessity become more and more refined. Whenever, in any period of our existence, we form or reform associations with a certain environment, and feel that we can move at ease in it and are made comfortable,
We begin quite naturally to make ourselves fast to it by putting out roots and tendrils. In so far as Madame Bonton was concerned, I believe also that Swann, in speaking of her with so much emphasis, was not sorry to think that my parents would hear that she had been to see his wife. To tell the truth, in our house, the names of the people whom Madame Swann was gradually getting to know pricked our curiosity more than they aroused our admiration. At the name of Madame Trombert, my mother exclaimed, "Ah, that's a new recruit, and one who will bring in others." And as though she found a similarity between the somewhat summary, rapid, and violent manner in which Madame Swann acquired her friends, as it were, by conquest and a colonial expedition, Mama went on to observe, "Now that the Tromberts have surrendered, the neighbouring tribes will not be long in coming in." If she had passed Madame Swann in the street, she would tell us when she came home, "I saw Madame Swann in all her war paint. She must have been embarking on some triumphant offensive against the Massachusetts or the Cingalese or the Tromberts." And so, with all the new people whom I told her that I had seen in that somewhat composite and artificial society, to which they had often been brought with great difficulty and from widely different surroundings, Mama would at once divine their origin, and speaking of them as of trophies dearly bought, would say, "Brought back from an expedition against the so-and-so." As for Madame Cottard, my father was astonished that Madame Swann could find anything to be gained by getting so utterly undistinguished a woman to come to her house, and said, "In spite of the professor's position, I must say that I cannot understand it." Mama, on the other hand, understood quite well. She knew that a great deal of the pleasure which a woman finds in entering a class of society different from that in which she has previously lived would be lacking if she had no means of keeping her old associates informed of those others, relatively more brilliant, with whom she has replaced them. Therefore, she requires an eyewitness who may be allowed to penetrate this new, delicious world, as a buzzing, browsing insect bores its way into a flower, and will then, as the course of her visits may carry her, spread abroad, or so at least one hopes, with the tidings, a latent germ of envy and wonder. Madame Cottard, who might have been created on purpose to fill this part, belonged to that special category in a visiting list which Mama, who inherited certain facets of her father's turn of mind, used to call the "Tell Sparta" people. Besides, apart from another reason which did not come to our knowledge until many years later, Madame Swann, in inviting this good-natured, reserved, and modest friend, had no need to fear lest she might be introducing into her drawing-room on her brilliant days a traitor or a rival. She knew what a vast number of homely blossoms that busy worker, armed with her plume and card-case, could visit in a single afternoon. She knew the creature's power of dissemination, and basing her calculations upon the law of probability, was led to believe that almost certainly some intimate of the Verdurins would be bound to hear within 2 or 3 days how the governor of Paris had left cards upon her, or that Monsieur Verdurin himself would be told how Monsieur Le Haut de Pressigny, the president of the horse show, had taken them, Swann and herself, to the King Theodosius gala. She imagined the Verdurins as informed of these two events, both so flattering to herself and of those alone, because the particular materializations in which we embody and pursue fame are but few in number by the default of our own minds, which are incapable of imagining at one time all the forms which, nonetheless, we hope, in a general way, that fame will not fail simultaneously to assume for our benefit. Madame Swann had, however, met with no success outside what was called the official world. Smart women did not go to her house. It was not the presence there of Republican notables that frightened them away.
In the days of my early childhood, conservative society was to the last degree worldly, and no good house would ever have opened its doors to a Republican. The people who lived in such an atmosphere imagined that the impossibility of ever inviting an opportunist, still more, a horrid radical, to their parties was something that would endure forever, like oil lamps and horse-drawn omnibuses. But, like a kaleidoscope which is every now and then given a turn, society arranges successively in different orders elements which one would have supposed to be immovable, and composes a fresh pattern. Before I had made my first communion, ladies on the right side in politics had had the stupefaction of meeting, while paying calls, a smart Jewess. These new arrangements of the kaleidoscope are produced by what a philosopher would call a change of criterion. The Dreyfus case brought about another. At a period rather later than that in which I began to go to Madame Swann's, and the kaleidoscope scattered once again its little scraps of colour. Everything Jewish, even the smart lady herself, fell out of the pattern, and various obscure nationalities appeared in its place. The most brilliant drawing room in Paris was that of a prince who was an Austrian and ultra-Catholic. If, instead of the Dreyfus case, there had come a war with Germany, the base of the kaleidoscope would have been turned in the other direction, and its pattern reversed. The Jews, having shown to the general astonishment that they were patriots also, would have kept their position, and no one would have cared to go any more, or even to admit that he had ever gone, to the Austrian princes. All this does not, however, prevent the people who move in it from imagining, whenever society is stationary for the moment, that no further change will occur, just as in spite of having witnessed the birth of the telephone, they decline to believe in the aeroplane. Meanwhile, the philosophers of journalism are at work, castigating the preceding epoch, and not only the kind of pleasures in which it indulged, which seemed to them to be the last word in corruption, but even the work of its artists and philosophers, which have no longer the least value in their eyes, as though they were indissolubly linked to the successive moods of fashionable frivolity. The one thing that does not change is that at any and every time it appears that there have been great changes. At the time when I went to Madame Swann's, the Dreyfus storm had not yet broken, and some of the more prominent Jews were extremely powerful. None more so than Sir Rufus Israels, whose wife, Lady Israels, was Swann's aunt. She had not herself any intimate acquaintance so distinguished as her nephews, while he, since he did not care for her, had never much cultivated her society, although he was, so far as was known, her heir. But she was the only one of Swann's relatives who had any idea of his social position, the others having always remained in the state of ignorance in that respect, which had long been our own. When from a family circle one of its members emigrates into high society, which to him appears a feat without parallel, until after the lapse of a decade he observes that it has been performed in other ways and for different reasons by more than one of the men whom he knew as boys, he draws round about himself a zone of shadow, a terra incognita, which is clearly visible in its minutest details to all those who inhabit it with him, but is darkest night and nothingness to those who may not penetrate it, but touch its fringe without the least suspicion of its existence in their midst. There being no news agency to furnish Swann's lady cousins with intelligence of the people with whom he consorted, it was, before his appalling marriage, of course, with a smile of condescension that they would tell one another over family dinner tables that they had spent a virtuous Sunday in going to see Cousin Charles, whom, regarding him as a poor relation who was inclined to envy their prosperity, they used wittily to name, playing upon the title of Balzac's story, Le Cousin Bête.
Lady Israel's, however, was letter perfect in the names and quality of the people who lavished upon Swan a friendship of which she was frankly jealous. Her husband's family, which almost equaled the Rothschilds in importance, had for several generations managed the affairs of the Orléans princes. Lady Israel's, being immensely rich, exercised a wide influence, and had employed it so as to ensure that no one whom she knew should be at home to Odette. One only had disobeyed her, in secret, the Comtesse de Marsante. And then, as ill luck would have it, Odette having gone to call upon Madame de Marsante, Lady Israel's had entered the room almost at her heels. Madame de Marsante was on tenterhooks. With the craven impotence of those who are at liberty to act as they choose, she did not address a single word to Odette, who thus found little encouragement to press further the invasion of a world which, moreover, was not at all that into which she would have liked to be welcomed. In this complete detachment of the Faubourg Saint-Germain, Odette continued to be regarded as the illiterate light woman, utterly different from the respectable ladies, well up in all the minutest points of genealogy, who endeavoured to quench by reading biographies and memoirs their thirst for the aristocratic relations with which real life had omitted to provide them. And Swann, for his part, continued no doubt to be the lover in whose eyes all these peculiarities of an old mistress would appear lovable, or at least inoffensive. For I have often heard his wife profess what were really social heresies, without his attempting, whether from lingering affection for her, loss of regard for society, or weariness of the effort to make her perfect, to correct them. It was perhaps also another form of the simplicity which for so long had misled us at Cambrai, and which now had the effect that, while he continued to know, on his own account at least, many highly distinguished people, he did not make a point in conversation in his wife's drawing-room of our seeming to feel that they were of the smallest importance. They had, indeed, less than ever for Swann, the centre of gravity of his life having been displaced. In any case, Odette's ignorance of social distinctions was so dense that if the name of the Princesse de Guermantes were mentioned in conversation after that of the Duchess, her cousin, "So, those ones are princes, are they?" she would exclaim. "Why, they've gone up a step." Were anyone to say, "The prince," in speaking of the Duc de Chartres, she would put him right with, "The duke, you mean? He is Duc de Chartres, not prince." As for the Duc d'Orléans, son of the Comte de Paris, "That's funny. The son is higher than the father," she would remark, adding, for she was afflicted with Anglomania, "Those royalties are so dreadfully confusing." While to someone who asked from what province the Guermantes family came, she replied, "From the Aisne." But so far as Odette was concerned, Swann was quite blind, not merely to these deficiencies in her education, but to the general mediocrity of her intelligence. More than that, whenever Odette repeated a silly story, Swann would sit listening to his wife with a complacency, a merriment, almost an admiration, into which some survival of his desire for her must have entered, while in the same conversation anything subtle, anything deep, even that he himself might say, would be listened to by Odette with an habitual lack of interest, rather curtly, with impatience, and would at times be sharply contradicted. And we must conclude that this enslavement of refinement by vulgarity is the rule in many households, when we think, conversely, of all the superior women who yield to the blandishments of a boor, merciless in his censure of their most delicate utterances, while they go into ecstasies with the infinite indulgence of love over the feeblest of his witticisms. To return to the reasons which prevented Odette at this period from making her way into the Faubourg Saint-Germain,
It must be observed that the latest turn of the social kaleidoscope had been actuated by a series of scandals. Women to whose houses one had been going with entire confidence had been discovered to be common prostitutes, if not British spies. One would, therefore, for some time to come, expect people, so at least one supposed, to be, before anything else, in a sound position, regular, settled, accountable. Odette represented simply everything with which one had just severed relations, and was incidentally to renew them at once, for men, their natures not altering from day to day, seek in every new order a continuance of the old, but to renew them by seeking it under another form, which would allow one to be innocently taken in, and to believe that it was no longer the same society as before the disaster. However, the scapegoats of that society and Odette were too closely alike. People who move in society are very short-sighted. At the moment in which they cease to have any relations with the Israelite ladies whom they have known, while they are asking themselves how they are to fill the gap thus made in their lives, they perceive, thrust into it as by the windfall of a night of storm, a new lady, an Israelite also, but by virtue of her novelty, she is not associated in their minds with her predecessors, with what they are convinced that they must abjure. She does not ask that they shall respect her God. They take her up. There was no question of anti-Semitism at the time when I used first to visit Odette, but she was like enough to it to remind people of what they wished for a while to avoid. As for Swan himself, he was still a frequent visitor of several of his former acquaintance, who, of course, were all of the very highest rank. And yet, when he spoke to us of the people whom he had just been to see, I noticed that among those whom he had known in the old days, the choice that he made was dictated by the same kind of taste, partly artistic, partly historic, that inspired him as a collector. And remarking that it was often some great lady or other of waning reputation who interested him, because she had been the mistress of Liszt or because one of Balzac's novels was dedicated to her grandmother, as he would purchase a drawing if Chateaubriand had written about it, I conceived a suspicion that we had at Cambrai replaced one error, that of regarding Swann as a mere stockbroker who did not go into society, by another, when we supposed him to be one of the smartest men in Paris. To be a friend of the Comte de Paris meant nothing at all. Is not the world full of such friends of princes, who would not be received in any house that was at all exclusive? Princes know themselves to be princes, and are not snobs. Besides, they believe themselves to be so far above everything that is not of their blood royal, that great nobles and businessmen appear in the depths beneath them to be practically on a level. But Swan went farther than this. Not content with seeking in society such as it was, when he fastened upon the names which, inscribed upon its roll by the past, were still to be read there, a simple artistic and literary pleasure, he indulged in the slightly vulgar diversion of arranging, as it were, social nosegays by grouping heterogeneous elements, bringing together people taken at hazard here, there, and everywhere. These experiments in the lighter side, or what was to Swan the lighter side, of sociology, did not stimulate an identical reaction with any regularity, that is to say, in each of his wife's friends. "I'm thinking of asking the Courtards to meet the Duchesse de Vendôme," he would laughingly say to Madame Bontemps, in the appetized tone of an epicure who has thought of and intends to try the substitution in a sauce of cayenne pepper for cloves. But this plan, which was in fact to appear quite humorous in an archaic sense of the word to the Courtards, had also the power of infuriating Madame Bontemps. She herself had recently been presented by the Swans to the Duchesse de Vendôme, and had found this as agreeable as it seemed to her natural.
The thought of winning renown from it at the Cotards, when she related to them what had happened, had been by no means the least savoury ingredient of her pleasure. But like those persons recently decorated, who, their investiture once accomplished, would like to see the fountain of honour turned off at the main, Madame Bontemps would have preferred that after herself, no one else in her own circle of friends should be known to the princess. She denounced, to herself of course, the licentious taste of Swann, who, in order to gratify a wretched aesthetic whim, was obliging her to scatter to the winds at one swoop all the dust that she would have thrown in the eyes of the Cotards when she told them about the Duchesse de Vendôme. How was she even to dare to announce to her husband that the professor and his wife were in their turn to partake of this pleasure, of which she had boasted to him as though it were unique? And yet, if the Cotards could only be made to know that they were being invited not seriously, but for the amusement of their host. It is true that the Bontemps had been invited for the same reason, but Swann, having acquired from the aristocracy that eternal Don Juan spirit, which, in treating with two women of no importance, makes each of them believe that it is she alone who is seriously loved, had spoken to Madame Bontemps, the Duchesse de Vendôme, as of a person whom it was clearly laid down that she must meet at dinner.
"Yes, we are determined to have the princess here with the Cotards," said Madame Swann a few weeks later. "My husband thinks that we might get something quite amusing out of that conjunction."
For if she had retained from the little nucleus certain habits dear to Madame Verdurin, such as that of shouting things aloud so as to be heard by all the faithful, she made use at the same time of certain expressions, such as conjunction, which were dear to the Guermantes circle, of which she thus felt unconsciously and at a distance, as the sea is swayed by the moon, the attraction, though without being drawn perceptibly closer to it. "Yes, the Cotards and the Duchesse de Vendôme. Don't you think that might be rather fun?" asked Swann.
"I think they'll be exceedingly ill-assorted, and it can only lead to a lot of bother. People oughtn't to play with fire, is what I say," snapped Madame Bontemps, furious.
She and her husband were, all the same, invited, as was the Prince d'Agrigente, to this dinner, which Madame Bontemps and Cotard had each two alternative ways of describing, according to whom they were telling about it. To one set, Madame Bontemps for her part, and Cotard for his, would say casually, when asked who else had been of the party, "Only the Prince d'Agrigente, it was all quite intimate." But there were others who might, alas, be better informed. Once, indeed, someone had challenged Cotard with, "But weren't the Bontemps there, too?" "Oh, I forgot them," Cotard had blushingly admitted to the tactless questioner, whom he ever afterwards classified among slanderers and speakers of evil. For these the Bontemps and Cotards had adopted, without any mutual arrangement, a version the framework of which was identical for both parties, their own names alone changing places. "Let me see," Cotard would say. "There were our host and hostess, the Duke and Duchesse de Vendôme," with a satisfied smile, "Professor and Madame Cotard, and upon my soul, heaven only knows how they got there, for they were about as much in keeping as hares in the soup, Monsieur and Madame Bontemps." Madame Bontemps would recite an exactly similar piece, only it was Monsieur and Madame Bontemps who were named with a satisfied emphasis between the Duchesse de Vendôme and the Prince d'Agrigente, while the also-ran, whom finally she used to accuse of having invited themselves and who completely spoiled the party, were the Cotards. When he had been paying calls, Swann would often come home with little time to spare before dinner. At that point in the evening, 6 o'clock, when in the old days he had felt so wretched, he no longer asked himself what Odette might be about, and was hardly at all concerned to hear that she had people still with her, or had gone out.
He recalled at times that he had once, years ago, tried to read through its envelope a letter addressed by Odette de Forcheville. But this memory was not pleasing to him, and rather than plumb the depths of shame that he felt in it, he preferred to indulge in a little grimace, twisting up the corners of his mouth and adding, if need be, a shake of the head, which signified, "What does it all matter?" In truth, he considered now that the hypothesis by which he had often been brought to a standstill in days gone by, according to which it was his jealous imagination alone that blackened what was in reality the innocent life of Odette, that this hypothesis, which after all was beneficent, since, so long as his amorous malady had lasted, it had diminished his sufferings by making them seem imaginary, was not the truth. That it was his jealousy that had seen things in the right light, and that if Odette had loved him better than he supposed, she had deceived him more as well. Formerly, while his sufferings were still keen, he had vowed that as soon as he should have ceased to love Odette, and so to be afraid either of vexing her or of making her believe that he loved her more than he did, he would afford himself the satisfaction of elucidating with her, simply from his love of truth and as a historical point, whether or not she had had Forcheville in her room that day when he had rung her bell and rapped on her window without being let in, and she had written to Forcheville that it was an uncle of hers who had called. But this so interesting problem, of which he was waiting to attempt the solution only until his jealousy should have subsided, had precisely lost all interest in Swann's eyes when he had ceased to be jealous. Not immediately, however. He felt no other jealousy now with regard to Odette than what the memory of that day, that afternoon spent in knocking vainly at the little house in the Rue La Pérouse, had continued to excite in him, as though his jealousy, not dissimilar in that respect from those maladies which appear to have their seat, their centre of contagion, less in certain persons than in certain places, in certain houses, had had for its object not so much Odette herself as that day, that hour in the irrevocable past when Swann had beaten at every entrance to her house in turn. You would have said that that day, that hour alone, had caught and preserved a few last fragments of the amorous personality which had once been Swann's, and that there alone could he now recapture them. For a long time now it had made no matter to him that Odette had been false to him, and was false still. And yet he had continued for some years to seek out old servants of Odette, so strongly in him persisted the painful curiosity to know whether on that day so long ago at 6 o'clock Odette had been in bed with Forcheville. Then that curiosity itself had disappeared, without, however, his abandoning his investigations. He continued the attempt to discover what no longer interested him, because his old ego, though it had shriveled to the extreme of decrepitude, still acted mechanically, following the course of preoccupations so utterly abandoned that Swann could not now succeed even in forming an idea of that anguish, so compelling once that he had been unable to foresee his ever being delivered from it, that only the death of her whom he loved, death which, as will be shown later on in this story by a cruel example, in no way diminishes the sufferings caused by jealousy, seemed to him capable of making smooth the road then insurmountably barred to him of his life. But to bring to light some day those passages in the life of Odette to which he owed his sufferings had not been Swann's only ambition. He had in reserve that also of wreaking vengeance for his sufferings when, being no longer in love with Odette, he should no longer be afraid of her, and the opportunity of gratifying this second ambition had just occurred, for Swann was in love with another woman, a woman who gave him grounds for jealousy, no, but who did all the same make him jealous, because he was not capable now of altering his way of making love, and it was the way he had used with Odette that must serve him now for another. To make Swann's jealousy revive, it was not essential that this woman should be unfaithful. It sufficed that for any reason she was separated from him, at a party, for instance, where she was presumably enjoying herself. That was enough to reawaken in him the old anguish, that lamentable and inconsistent excrescence of his love, which held Swann ever at a distance from what she really was, like a yearning to attain the impossible, what this young woman really felt for him, the hidden longing that absorbed her days, the secret places of her heart. For between Swann and her whom he loved, this anguish piled up an unyielding mass of already existing suspicions, having their cause in Odette, or in some other perhaps who had preceded Odette, allowing this now aging lover to know his mistress of the moment only in the traditional and collective phantasm of the woman who made him jealous, in which he had arbitrarily incarnated his new love. Often, however, Swann would charge his jealousy with the offence of making him believe in imaginary infidelities. But then he would remember that he had given Odette the benefit of the same argument, and had in that been wrong. And so everything that the young woman whom he loved did in those hours when he was not with her appeared spoilt of its innocence in his eyes. But whereas at that other time he had made a vow that if ever he ceased to love her, whom he did not then imagine to be his future wife, he would implacably exhibit to her an indifference that would at length be sincere, so as to avenge his pride that had so long been trampled upon by her, of those reprisals which he might now enforce without risk to himself, for what harm could it do to him to be taken at his word, and deprived of those intimate moments with Odette that had been so necessary to him once? Of those reprisals he took no more thought. With his love had vanished the desire to show that he was in love no longer. And he who, when he was suffering at the hands of Odette, would have looked forward so keenly to letting her see one day that he had fallen to a rival, now that he was in a position to do so, took infinite precautions lest his wife should suspect the existence of this new love. It was not only in those tea parties, on account of which I had formerly had the sorrow of seeing Gilberte leave me and go home earlier than usual, that I was henceforth to take part, but the engagements that she had with her mother, to go for a walk or to some afternoon party, which by preventing her from coming to the Champs-Élysées had deprived me of her, on those days when I loitered alone upon the lawn or stood before the wooden horses. To these outings Monsieur and Madame Swann henceforth admitted me. I had a seat in their landau, and indeed it was me that they asked if I would rather go to the theatre, to a dancing lesson at the house of one of Gilberte's friends, to some social gathering given by friends of her parents, what Odette called a little meeting, or to visit the tombs at Saint-Denis. On days when I was going anywhere with the Swans, I would arrive at the house in time for déjeuner, which Madame Swann called le lunch. As one was not expected before 12:30, while my parents in those days had their meal at 11:15, it was not until they had risen from the table that I made my way towards that sumptuous quarter, deserted enough at any hour, but more particularly just then when everyone had gone indoors. Even on winter days of frost, if the weather held, tightening every few minutes the knot of a gorgeous necktie from Charvet's, and looking to see that my varnished boots were not getting dirty, I would roam to and fro among the avenues, waiting until 27 minutes past the hour. I could see from afar in the Swan's little garden plot the sunlight glittering like hoar-frost from the bare boughed trees. It is true that the garden boasted but a pair of them. The unusual hour presented the scene in a new light. Into these pleasures of nature, intensified by the suppression of habit and indeed by my physical hunger, the thrilling prospect of sitting down to luncheon with Madame Swan was infused. It did not diminish them, but taking command of them trained them to its service, so that if at this hour when ordinarily I did not perceive them, I seemed now to be discovering the fine weather, the cold, the wintry sunlight. It was all as a sort of preface to the creamed eggs, as a patina, a cool and coloured glaze applied to the decoration of that mystic chapel which was the habitation of Madame Swan, and in the heart of which there were, by contrast, so much warmth, so many scents and flowers. At 12:30, I would finally make up my mind to enter that house, which, like an immense Christmas stocking, seemed ready to bestow upon me supernatural delights. The French name Noël was, by the way, unknown to Madame Swan and Gilberte, who had substituted for it the English Christmas, and would speak of nothing but Christmas pudding. What people had given them as Christmas presents, and of going away, the thought of which maddened me with grief, for Christmas. At home, even, I should have thought it degrading to use the word Noël, and always said Christmas, which my father considered extremely silly. I encountered no one at first but a footman, who, after leading me through several large drawing-rooms, showed me into one that was quite small, empty, its windows beginning to dream already in the blue light of afternoon. I was left alone there in the company of orchids, roses, and violets, which, like people who are kept waiting in a room beside you but do not know you, preserved a silence which their individuality as living things made all the more impressive, and received coldly the warmth of a glowing fire of coals, preciously displayed behind a screen of crystal in a basin of white marble over which it spilled now and again its perilous rubies. I had sat down, but I rose hurriedly on hearing the door opened. It was only another footman, and then a third, and the minute result that their vainly alarming entrances and exits achieved was to put a little more coal on the fire or water in the vases. They departed. I found myself alone, once that door was shut which Madame Swan was surely soon going to open. Of a truth, I should have been less ill at ease in a magician's cave than in this little waiting-room, where the fire appeared to me to be performing alchemical transmutations, as in Klingsor's laboratory. Footsteps sounded afresh. I did not rise. It was sure to be just another footman. It was Monsieur Swan.
"What? All by yourself? What is one to do? That poor wife of mine has never been able to remember what time means. 10 minutes to 1. She gets later every day. And you'll see, she will come sailing in without the least hurry and imagine she's in heaps of time." And as he was still subject to neuritis, and as he was becoming a trifle ridiculous, the fact of possessing so unpunctual a wife, who came in so late from the Bois, forgot everything at her dressmaker's and was never in time for luncheon, made Swan anxious for his digestion, but flattered his self-esteem. He showed me his latest acquisitions and explained their interest to me, but my emotion, added to the unfamiliarity of being still without food at this hour, sweeping through my mind, left it void, so that while able to speak, I was incapable of hearing. Anyhow, so far as the works of art in Swan's possession were concerned, it was enough for me that they were contained in his house, formed a part there of the delicious hour that preceded luncheon. The Gioconda herself might have appeared there without giving me any more pleasure than one of Madame Swan's indoor gowns or her scent bottles. I continued to wait, alone or with Swan, and often with Gilberte come in to keep us company. The arrival of Madame Swan, prepared for me by all those majestic apparitions, must, so it seemed to me, be something truly immense. I strained my ears to catch the slightest sound, but one never finds quite as high as one has been expecting, a cathedral, a wave in a storm, a dancer's leap in the air. After those liveried footmen suggesting the chorus, whose professional entry upon the stage leads up to and at the same time diminishes the final appearance of the Queen, Madame Swan, creeping furtively in with a little otter-skin coat, her veil lowered to cover a nose pink-tipped by the cold, did not fulfil the promises lavished while I had been waiting upon my imagination. But if she had stayed at home all morning, when she arrived in the drawing-room, she would be clad in a wrapper of crepe de chine, brightly coloured, which seemed to me more exquisite than any of her dresses. Sometimes the Swans decided to remain in the house all afternoon, and then, as we had had luncheon so late, very soon I must watch setting beyond the garden wall the sun of that day which had seemed to me bound to be different from other days. Then in vain might the servants bring in lamps of every size and shape, burning each upon the consecrated altar of a console, a card-table, a corner-cupboard, a bracket, as though for the celebration of some strange and secret rite. Nothing extraordinary transpired in the conversation, and I went home disappointed, as one often is in one's childhood, after the midnight mass. But my disappointment was scarcely more than mental. I was radiant with happiness in this house where Gilberte, when she was still not with us, was about to appear and would bestow on me in a moment and for hours to come her speech, her smiling and attentive gaze, just as I had caught it first that time at Combray. At the most, I was a trifle jealous when I saw her so often disappear into vast rooms above, reached by a private staircase. Obliged myself to remain in the drawing-room, like a man in love with an actress who is confined to his stall in front and wonders anxiously what is going on behind the scenes in the green-room, I put to Swan with regard to this other part of the house questions artfully veiled, but in a tone from which I could not quite succeed in banishing the note of uneasiness. He explained to me that the place to which Gilberte had gone was the linen-room, offered himself to show it to me, and promised me that whenever Gilberte had occasion to go there again, he would insist upon her taking me with her. By these last words, and the relief which they brought me, Swan at once annihilated for me one of those terrifying interior perspectives at the end of which a woman with whom we are in love appears so remote. At that moment I felt for him an affection which I believed to be deeper than my affection for Gilberte, for he, being the master over his daughter, was giving her to me, whereas she withheld herself now and then. I had not the same direct control over her as I had indirectly through Swan. Besides, it was she whom I loved, and could not therefore look upon without that disturbance, without that desire for something more, which destroys in us, in the presence of one whom we love, the sensation of loving. As a rule, however, we did not stay indoors. We went out. Sometimes, before going to dress, Madame Swan would sit down at the piano, her lovely hands escaping from the pink or white or often vividly coloured sleeves of her crepe de chine wrapper, drooped over the keys with that same melancholy which was in her eyes, but was not in her heart. It was on one of those days that she happened to play me the part of Vinteuil's sonata that contained the little phrase of which Swan had been so fond. But often one listens and hears nothing, if it is a piece of music at all complicated to which one is listening for the first time. And yet when, later on, this sonata had been played over to me two or three times, I found that I knew it quite well. And so it is not wrong to speak of hearing a thing for the first time. If one had, indeed, as one supposes, received no impression from the first hearing, the second, the third, would be equally first hearings, and there would be no reason why one should understand it any better after the tenth. Probably what is wanting the first time is not comprehension, but memory. For our memory, compared to the complexity of the impressions which it has to face while we are listening, is infinitesimal, as brief as the memory of a man who in his sleep thinks of a thousand things and at once forgets them, or as that of a man in his second childhood who cannot recall a minute afterwards what one has just been saying to him. Of these multiple impressions, our memory is not capable of furnishing us with an immediate picture. But that picture gradually takes shape, and with regard to works which we have heard more than once, we are like the schoolboy who has read several times over before going to sleep a lesson which he supposed himself not to know, and finds that he can repeat it by heart next morning. It was only that I had not until then heard a note of the sonata, whereas Swann and his wife could make out a distinct phrase that was as far beyond the range of my perception as a name which one endeavours to recall and in place of which one discovers only a void from which an hour later, when one is not thinking about them, will spring of their own accord, in one continuous flight, the syllables that one has solicited in vain. And not only does one not seize at once and retain an impression of works that are really great, but even in the content of any such work, as befell me in the case of Van Tuyl's sonata, it is the least valuable parts that one at first perceives. Thus it was that I was mistaken not only in thinking that this work held nothing further in store for me, so that for a long time I made no effort to hear it again, from the moment in which Madame Swann had played over to me its most famous passage. I was in this respect as stupid as people are who expect to feel no astonishment when they stand in Venice before the front of St. Mark's, because photography has already acquainted them with the outline of its domes. Far more than that, even when I had heard the sonata played from beginning to end, it remained almost wholly invisible to me, like a monument of which its distance or a haze in the atmosphere allows us to catch but a faint and fragmentary glimpse. Hence the depression inseparable from one's knowledge of such works, as of everything that acquires reality in time. When the least obvious beauties of Van Tuyl's sonata were revealed to me, already borne by the force of habit beyond the reach of my sensibility, those that I had from the first distinguished and preferred in it were beginning to escape, to avoid me. Since I was able only in successive moments to enjoy all the pleasures that this sonata gave me, I never possessed it in its entirety. It was like life itself. But less disappointing than life is, great works of art do not begin by giving us all their best. In Van Tuyl's sonata, the beauties that one discovers at once are those also of which one most soon grows tired, and for the same reason, no doubt, namely, that they are less different from what one already knows. But when those first apparitions have withdrawn, there is left for our enjoyment some passage which its composition, too new and strange to offer anything but confusion to our mind, had made indistinguishable and so preserved intact. And this, which we have been meeting every day and have not guessed it, which has thus been held in reserve for us, which by the sheer force of its beauty has become invisible and has remained unknown, this comes to us last of all. But this also must be the last that we shall relinquish, and we shall love it longer than the rest, because we have taken longer to get to love it. The time, moreover, that a person requires, as I required in the matter of this sonata, to penetrate a work of any depth, is merely an epitome, a symbol, one might say, of the years, the centuries even, that must elapse before the public can begin to cherish a masterpiece that is really new. So that the man of genius, to shelter himself from the ignorant contempt of the world, may say to himself that, since one's contemporaries are incapable of the necessary detachment, works written for posterity should be read by posterity alone, like certain pictures which one cannot appreciate when one stands too close to them. But as it happens, any such cowardly precaution to avoid false judgments is doomed to failure. They are inevitable. The reason for which a work of genius is not easily admired from the first is that the man who has created it is extraordinary, that few other men resemble him. It was Beethoven's quartets themselves, the 12th, 13th, 14th, and 15th, that devoted half a century to forming, fashioning, and enlarging a public for Beethoven's quartets, marking in this way, like every great work of art, an advance if not in artistic merit, at least in intellectual society, largely composed today of what was not to be found when the work first appeared, that is to say, of persons capable of enjoying it. What artists call posterity is the posterity of the work of art. It is essential that the work, leaving out of account for brevity's sake the contingency that several men of genius may at the same time be working along parallel lines to create a more instructed public in the future, a public from which other men of genius shall reap the benefit, shall create its own posterity. For if the work were held in reserve, were revealed only to posterity, that audience for that particular work would be not posterity, but a group of contemporaries who were merely living half a century later in time. And so it is essential that the artist, and this is what Van Teuil had done, if he wishes his work to be free to follow its own course, shall launch it wherever he may find sufficient depth, confidently outward bound towards the future. And yet this interval of time, the true perspective in which to behold a work of art, if leaving it out of account is the mistake made by bad judges, taking it into account is at times a dangerous precaution of the good. No doubt one can easily imagine, by an illusion similar to that which makes everything on the horizon appear equidistant, that all the revolutions which have hitherto occurred in painting or in music did at least show respect for certain rules, whereas that which immediately confronts us, be it impressionism, a striving after discord, an exclusive use of the Chinese scale, cubism, futurism, or what you will, differs outrageously from all that have occurred before. Simply because those that have occurred before we are apt to regard as a whole, forgetting that a long process of assimilation has melted them into a continuous substance, varied, of course, but taking it as a whole homogeneous, in which Hugo blends with Molière. Let us try to imagine the shocking incoherence that we should find if we did not take into account the future and the changes that it must bring about in a horoscope of our own riper years, drawn and presented to us in our youth. Only horoscopes are not always accurate, and the necessity when judging a work of art of including the temporal factor in the sum total of its beauty introduces, to our way of thinking, something as hazardous and consequently as barren of interest as every prophecy the non-fulfillment of which will not at all imply any inadequacy on the prophet's part. For the power to summon possibilities into existence, or to exclude them from it, is not necessarily within the competence of genius. One may have had genius and yet not have believed in the future of railways or of flight, or, although a brilliant psychologist, in the infidelity of a mistress or of a friend whose treachery persons far less gifted would have foreseen. If I did not understand the sonata, it enchanted me to hear Madame Swann play. Her touch appeared to me like her wrappers, like the scent of her staircase, her cloaks, her chrysanthemums, to form a part of an individual and mysterious whole, in a world infinitely superior to that in which the mind is capable of analysing talent. "Attractive, isn't it, that Van Teuil sonata?" Swann asked me. "The moment when night is darkening among the trees, when the arpeggios of the violin call down a cooling dew upon the earth. You must admit that it is rather charming. It shows all the static side of moonlight, which is the essential part. It is not surprising that a course of radiant heat, such as my wife is taking, should act on the muscles, since moonlight can prevent the leaves from stirring. That is what he expresses so well in that little phrase, the Bois de Boulogne plunged in a cataleptic trance. By the sea it is even more striking, because you have there the faint response of the waves, which, of course, you can hear quite distinctly, since nothing else dares to move. In Paris, it is the other way. At the most, you may notice unfamiliar lights among the old buildings, the sky brightened as though by a colourless and harmless conflagration, that sort of vast variety show of which you get a hint here and there. But in Vinteuil's little phrase, and in the whole sonata for that matter, it is not like that. The scene is laid in the bois. In the gruppetto you can distinctly hear a voice saying, "I can almost see to read the paper." These words from Swann might have falsified later on my impression of the sonata, music being too little exclusive to inhibit absolutely what other people suggest that we should find in it. But I understood from other words which he let fall that this nocturnal foliage was simply that beneath whose shade in many a restaurant on the outskirts of Paris he had listened on many an evening to the little phrase. In place of the profound significance that he had so often sought in it, what it recalled now to Swann were the leafy boughs, arranged, wreathed, painted about it, which gave him the desire to see again because it seemed to him to be their inner, their hidden self, as it were their soul, was the whole of one spring season, which he had not been able to enjoy before, not having had, feverish and moody as he then was, enough strength of body and mind for its enjoyment, which, as one puts by for an invalid the dainties that he has not been able to eat, it had kept in store for him. The charm that he had been made to feel by certain evenings in the bois, a charm of which Vinteuil's sonata served to remind him, he could not have recaptured by questioning Odette, although she, as well as the little phrase, had been his companion there. But Odette had been merely his companion, by his side, not, as the phrase had been, within him, and so had seen nothing. Nor would she, had she been a thousand times as comprehending, have seen anything of that vision which, for no one among us, or at least I was long under the impression that this rule admitted no exception, can be made externally visible. "It is rather charming, don't you think?" Swann continued. "That sound can give a reflection, like water or glass." It is curious, too, that Vinteuil's phrase now shows me only the things to which I paid no attention then. Of my troubles, my loves of those days, it recalls nothing. It has altered all my values.
"Charles, I don't think that's very polite to me, what you're saying."
"Not polite? Really, you women are superb. I was simply trying to explain to this young man that what the music shows, to me at least, is not for a moment free will or in tune with the infinite, but shall we say old Verdurin in his frock coat in the palm house at the Jardin d'Acclimation. Hundreds of times without my leaving this room, the little phrase has carried me off to dine with it at Armenonville. Gad, it is less boring anyhow than having to go there with Madame de Cambremer." Madame Swann laughed.
"That is a lady who is supposed to have been violently in love with Charles," she explained, in the same tone in which, shortly before, when we were speaking of Vermeer of Delft, of whose existence I had been surprised to find her conscious, she had answered me with, "I ought to explain that Monsieur Swann was very much taken up with that painter at the time he was courting me. Isn't that so, Charles, dear?"
"You're not to start saying things about Madame de Cambremer," Swann checked her, secretly flattered.
"But I'm only repeating what I've been told. Besides, it seems that she is an extremely clever woman. I don't know her myself. I believe she's very pushing, which surprises me rather in a clever woman. But everyone says that she was quite mad about you. There's no harm in repeating that.
Swan remained silent as a deaf mute, which was in a way of confirmation of what she had said, and a proof of his own fatuity.
"Since what I'm playing reminds you of the Jardin d'Acclimatation," his wife went on with a playful semblance of being offended, "we might take him there some day in the carriage, if it would amuse him. It's lovely there just now, and you can recapture your fond impressions. Which reminds me, talking of the Jardin d'Acclimatation, do you know, this young man thought that we were devotedly attached to a person whom I cut, as a matter of fact, whenever I possibly can. Madame Blatin.
I think it is rather crushing for us that she should be taken for a friend of ours.
Just fancy, dear Dr. Cottard, who never says a harsh word about anyone, declares that she's positively contagious.
A frightful woman. The one thing to be said for her is that she is exactly like Savonarola. She is the very image of that portrait of Savonarola by Fra Bartolomeo." This mania which Swan had for finding likenesses to people in pictures was defensible, for even what we call individual expression is, as we so painfully discover when we are in love and would fain believe in the unique reality of the beloved, something diffused and general which can be found existing at different periods. But if one had listened to Swan, the processions of the kings of the East, already so anachronistic when Benozzo Gozzoli introduced in their midst various Medici, would have been even more so, since they would have included the portraits of a whole crowd of men, contemporaries not of Gozzoli, but of Swan, subsequent, that is to say, not only by 15 centuries to the Nativity, but by 4 more to the painter himself. There was not missing from those trains, according to Swan, a single living Parisian of any note, any more than there was from that act in one of Sardou's plays, in which, out of friendship for the author and for the leading lady, and also because it was the fashion, all the best-known men in Paris, famous doctors, politicians, barristers, amused themselves, each on a different evening, by walking on. But what has she got to do with the Jardin d'Acclimatation?
Everything.
What? You don't suggest that she's got a sky blue behind, like the monkeys?
Charles, you really are too dreadful. I was thinking of what the Cingalese said to her. Do tell him, Charles. It really is a gem.
Oh, it's too silly. You know Madame Blatin loves asking people questions, in a tone which she thinks friendly, but which is really overpowering.
What our good friends on the Thames call patronizing, interrupted Odette.
Exactly. Well, she went the other day to the Jardin d'Acclimatation, where they have some blackamoors. Cingalese, I think I heard my wife say. She's much better up in ethnology than I am.
Now, Charles, you're not to make fun of poor me.
I've no intention of making fun, I assure you. Well, to continue, she went up to one of these black fellows with, "Good morning, nigger."
Oh, it's too absurd.
Anyhow, this classification seems to have displeased the black. "Me, nigger," he shouted, quite furious, don't you know, to Madame Blatin. "Me, nigger, you old cow."
I do think that's so delightful. I adore that story. Do say it's a good one. Can't you see old Blatin standing there and hearing him, "Me, nigger, you old cow?"
I expressed an intense desire to go there and see these Cingalese, one of whom had called Madame Blatin an old cow. They did not interest me in the least. But I reflected that in going to the Jardin d'Acclimatation and again on our way home, we should pass along that Allée des Acacias, in which I had loved so once to gaze on Madame Swan, and that perhaps Coquelin's mulatto friend, to whom I had never managed to exhibit myself in the act of saluting her, would see me there, seated at her side, as the Victoria swept by. During those minutes in which Gilberte, having gone to get ready, was not in the room with us, Monsieur and Madame Swann would take delight in revealing to me all the rare virtues of their child, and everything that I myself observed seemed to prove the truth of what they said. I remarked that, as her mother had told me, she had not only for her friends but for the servants, for the poor, the most delicate attentions carefully thought out, a desire to give pleasure, a fear of causing annoyance, translated into all sorts of trifling actions which must often have meant great inconvenience to her.